Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Josh Brown, how many times are you going to be watching Madam Web? I own you and Patterson, dying to know.
This is not the question I was expecting to start this podcast with, but it's perhaps the most perfect question, so thank you, Ewan. I'm going to see Madam Web so many times that Sony can justify a sequel. I'm going to be at least 45% of that thing's box office revenue because, good Lord, I cannot wait.
I think you can wait. I imagine that they'll take, if you take a photo every time you go in a different seat and then you put them all together, it'll be you and the entire audience. being the one man sustaining this entire endeavour. I don't know what it is.
Over my break, I actually rewatched Venom 1 and Venom 2, and they were both better than I originally gave them credit for. Like, they're not good. The Sony universe is obviously just an absolute trash fire. Like, I saw Morbius in theatres.
Why did you do that?
I don't know, man. I was having a breakdown last year. One of that was probably part of it.
I love, like, the idea of, like, you being, like, Vegeta in the tank, like, recovering in Dragon Ball, but you're, like, what's being plugged into you is, like, the Sony cinematic universe. Like, yeah, this'll sort him out.
Well, that's it, man. So I thought, I got really interested into it for whatever reason, but I genuinely think those Venom movies are good. But what fascinates me is how short and how many corners Sony cuts with them. Like, I absolutely burst out laughing when Venom 2 ended. At the 80-minute mark, like, that thing's 80 minutes. It's had so much clearly cut out of it. And then I was laughing again when they announced that Madam Web was the longest Sony movie at 1 hour 56. Like, these things are just, they're just pumped out. They're, like, cut down to the shortest runtime possible. And, I mean, the trailer for Madam Web looked absolutely insane and up my street. And the weird marketing with Dakota Johnson, I'm here for it, man.
What the hell was that? Like, I don't know what we're going for anymore. Like, it's just this thing. Madam Web is, like, throwing together all the various parts of the Spider-Man mythos, let's say, that Sony are, like, in control of. And I saw a thing where they've cast, like, another Uncle Ben, and there's, like, a fake Spider-Man in it. And I was like, what is this? And then, like, the Dakota Johnson thing was, like, doing, like, a sort of sultry ASMR thing where it's like, please go watch it. And I'm like, okay, like, what is this? Like, is this just every marketing whim all at once?
It's strange, man. Like, I love the Sony, you know what? The Sony cinematic universe of Spider-Man characters, which is such a mouthful. Is to me what I wanted the Dark Universe to be. You know, when that was first announced and you saw, like, that cast photo and you knew it was going to be bad, but there was something endearingly bad about it. There was something so tin pot about the whole enterprise that I just kind of was drawn to it. And the Sony universe is that for me, where I get a lot of enjoyment out of it and I can't get angry at it until it starts really trying to be a cinematic universe. And what I mean by that is, for instance, the end of Morbius, spoilers, when Michael Keaton's Vulture suddenly arrives in the universe. And I'm like, oh, now you are getting into territory that I actually like and you might mess it up.
As long as for the love of God, don't take it seriously.
Literally. As long as you don't take this seriously and you don't incorporate or tarnish things that are actually good, I'm okay with you being this weird side pocket universe. In fact, I'm here for it.
That thing, and we'll move on from Madam Web. I will say this is the entitled part of podcast, UBP. I'm Scott Tilford, that's Josh Brown, filling in for Jules Gill, who's off doing a business yet again. Although the business he's doing is a Warhammer tournament, so if anyone listens to this on Friday, Dune's doing some sort of big old Warhammer tournament. He did tell me where it was, I forgot, but it's some big thing, and that's where he'll be. But yeah, the Man of Web stuff, in that trailer there's that one line that sort of went viral as being the worst line delivery in quite some time. But if you apply your methodology to it, that's intentionally like naff and crap and whatever, and they're just kind of having fun with it. So I'm like, maybe there's a way for them to just steer all the way into the campness, which I would love them to do. Like, there's a way to absolutely do that, but I feel like they're taking it too seriously. And then you've got Sony going like, what if we had a multiverse reference in Spider-Man 2, and what if we planned a multiplayer game, and what if we just tried our own Marvel thing? I have such a problem with Sony's handling of Spider-Man, and I don't like any of it.
No, I sort of see the danger of that, absolutely. Like, yeah, there is a way for these movies to take themselves way too seriously. Morbius definitely suffered from that. Like, in my opinion, that movie wasn't even so bad it's good. I think Matt Smith's performance errs on that side, but everything else sort of feels like, you know, the original Suicide Squad movie after it was recut. It just sort of seems like it's trying a little bit too hard. But with Madam Web, that kind of, at least from the trailer, it seems to fall on the right side of campy and endearing, to me anyway. And I genuinely do like the characters that it is based around, so I'm interested to see how they've been adapted in that sense. But I thought Venom 1 and 2, they're not amazing movies, but they have a lot of heart. Like, you can tell that Tom Hardy at least knows what movie he's making.
That's true.
And he sort of elevates it. And I hope with Madam Web that the actors know what kind of movie they're making and are able to bring their own personalities to it in a way that elevates the almost certain to be mid material.
You're like the most like up for this movie of anyone that I've seen online or talked to or anything. I hope it's worth your time when
yeah,
it finds,
man,
when
yeah
it
like I'm the most up for it, and I'm also mentally ill, so what does that say to the target audience of this film?
But it's, you're coming back out the trough, my friend. You leave those things behind. Speaking of looking forward to things, Willie Reyes says the legend is back, which is very, very true. With only weeks until Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, will Josh finally play Crisis Core before it comes out? If not, would Scott run an abridged explanation for him? We also had Jack Jingle saying, in regards to Final Fantasy Rebirth and asking about hype, he's equally scared as he is excited. I thought we'd use this as a general chat on Final Fantasy, because me and you haven't talked about Rebirth since you've came back, or in a few months anyway. I know you sold Crisis Core because you were like, I'm sick of this thing. And where you are on all the Final Fantasy stuff?
In a weird position with it, because I did play Crisis Core, goddammit.
You played me as well. I was like, this is terrible.
I would love you to give me an abridged version of that story, because I was there for the story, but I just couldn't get over the gameplay.
Right.
And so, unfortunately, I won't be going back to the game itself, but I will be going to you to tell me what the hell happened in the rest of that.
The thing that's like so weird with all this, and it was so weird when they rolled it out, is like, Crisis Core is fundamentally an answer to a big plot point in Final Fantasy VII. Like everything that Zack does and what Zack is and everything else used to be a reveal. Used to be a whole part of the entire point of Final Fantasy VII and the entire point of the main arc of that game. So I don't. And then when they were like, "Oh, we're going to remaster Final Crisis Core, and we're going to put that out," and then I think on Square's side, or maybe Tetsuya Nomura's side, like the Creative Minds side, they want people to play Crisis Core. So going into Rebirth, you know, for whatever reason, the extra context kind of thing, it just doesn't make any sense. Because then, like, I don't know what story you're then going to do in 7 Rebirth, because you've kind of, like, you've revealed stuff in the wrong order. Like, it's just this weird thing. So it's like, I don't know how much they want people to know. I guess they want people to know the Crisis Core story. But yeah, I'm also on a weird line with it, where I don't know what the average person who hasn't played Crisis Core wants to know. And I don't know how Rebirth's going to tackle Zack overall. Like, he was in Integrate as well, like the little DLC story thing they did for Final Fantasy VII Rebirth after the main game, and they did another scene including him. And it's so like, okay, you kind of want us to have this like mystery thing of like, who's Zack, what's going on, why is he holding Cloud, and like, what is that? And I'm like, well, I can answer that right now. Like, I know from the wider Final Fantasy VII story what that is, where it sits in the timeline and everything else. But then the way that they've revealed it and the way that they messed it up, or like messed it around, like in a positive way, I guess, at the end of Final Fantasy VII 2021, that was like a whole thing where they were like, oh, we're changing it all up, and then we're showing you this scene that you're not supposed to see for another 40-odd hours or whatever it is. And I'm just like, I'm so lost on like what their intention is with this. And I think my worst case scenario, and I've not mentioned this in a video yet, but like I played Final Fantasy VII Ever Crisis, which is like the loot based gacha game that's on mobile, where they just take every little scene from Final Fantasy VII and put random skins and loot components and microtransactions into it and just monetize the living F out of it. Like, it's horrible. And so like that thing opens with the mention of a multiverse and says, hey, look, we can get away with all this and all these other variations of this timeline because it's an infinite multiverse. And look, we've got all the Aeriths now earlier on with Cloud in the reactor and like whatever. And I was like, oh, is this all you're doing? Is this all this is? Everyone else is doing multiverse stuff and that's what you guys are doing. And you have been for the last few years. I truly hope, and I'm not a religious man, pray to all the gods, that that is not the reveal that we're actually building to after all this time. So it's a long-winded way of saying that I actually don't want to give you an abridged version of it. Or I can, me and you, I can tell you, but I feel weirdly bad doing it for a mass audience because there should still be something to preserve there about the main story of Final Fantasy VII. And I'm just so lost on what they want people to know.
Yeah.
And so like I get like, you played a certain chunk of Crisis Core and then kind of dipped out. And ultimately, I guess you didn't get to the back third, which is where it ties into Final Fantasy VII and Cloud and everything. And I have no idea what the average person would like to know at this point. And maybe they're just going to stick to the main games.
It is so weird to be along for this ride, especially as someone who only has passing knowledge of Final Fantasy VII. I think the original remake was interesting because I reckon that there are some parts of Final Fantasy VII that even if you haven't played it, even if you don't follow the franchise, were sort of ingrained in video game lore. And I'm almost hesitant to even say them now because in a weird way, they've now become like relevant spoilers for the next game that's about to come out. But there are a few big beats from that game that, you know, felt so iconic that everyone knew them, or at least everyone of a certain age. So
yes,
playing through the remake, even though I only had that tiny amount of knowledge, I still sort of appreciated the way they were kind of acknowledging what you expect to happen and circumventing that in certain ways. Even if I didn't know the specifics, you know, like who Zack was, I knew how the part he generally played within that story and his status within that story, let's say. You know, the same thing can apply to Aerith or Cloud or Barret or whoever, you know? So I thought that was interesting that it kind of still worked on that, not meta level, but that knowing level and subversive level for someone who was a non-fan like me, as much as it probably did for you. But at the same time, there are still so many elements of that game that just left me completely puzzled. You know, some characters that are introduced towards the end that if you don't have the reference point for, you're just sat there thinking like, who's this? What?
Yeah,
when they cut
to Ketchi and all you see, all you saw, people who don't know Final Fantasy, is just a little cat with a crown on. That's a very, like, to me, like, oh my god, it's Ketchi, but like, sure, that's a whole thing.
Absolutely. So I have no idea where the game is going next. Like, I didn't realize how much of the original Final Fantasy VII wasn't set in Midgard, you know? So I genuinely don't. I know, again, some of the beats towards the end, but I don't know how we get there. I don't know how we're supposed to get there. Don't know which characters are supposed to live or die, that kind of thing. So going into this sequel, I'm up for that kind of craziness and that kind of high conceptedness of it. But at the same time, for as much as I loved Final Fantasy VII Remake initially, since playing 16 and since dabbling into Crisis Core, me personally, I always seem to have a major drawback with these games. Like there's parts of them that I adore and love and think of fondly, but the experience as a whole often has drawbacks. That was certainly the case for 16 in terms of some of its combat, some of its side quests. And that was certainly the case for 7 when you got towards the filler padding towards the end. So I'm up for it, but I'm also more hesitant than I was going into 16 because I'm expecting those roadblocks again. And I hope they're not there. I hope they can give me a complete experience this time around.
Yeah, the way that they're handling it, where like you had like all of what they called Final Fantasy VII Remake was just Midgar, which is like ultimately like the first sort of fifth of the game. And then you, back in the 90s when we first played through Final Fantasy, it was like this whole reveal of the world map. And oh my God, there's so much more to this game. And some of that, like their reaction to that was because like people didn't keep up with games as much. Like unless you were buying a magazine or something, it's not like you weren't online. So like that was a whole reveal. And I like that they've tried to replicate that. But at the same time, it, like you said, it was such a... They had to put so much filler in the 2021 just to try and like give you a full game's worth. And for me, like, yeah, they remixed the story so much in regards to bringing Sephiroth in much earlier. And like that Sephiroth used to be a mystery, like, but obviously now Final Fantasy VII is the Sephiroth Cloud story, so we just led with that. And Tetsuya Nomura and the various staff were saying, like, look, we need to, that is what Final Fantasy VII is, and people will be expecting that. And I'm like, I was always like, nah, like, if you were remaking Jaws, you wouldn't have him in the opening scene or something. You're still supposed to build to that. That's the whole point. But whatever. Like, yeah, I guess we'll see how that stuff shakes out. I'm just weird with it at the minute. Like, I appreciate how much they've done. And I like the footage that they've shown and how massive the open world is. Because the world map is literally an entire world with multiple continents in the PS1 one. And so it's like you need to make a whole world work, you know, and render it properly and everything else. And they always used to say, like, there's too much game to remake. That's why we're not going to do it. And so once they embarked on this, I was like, how are you going to convey the idea of actually going from the west to the east online? In a new version kind of thing. But I guess we'll see.
I do think it's peculiar as well, at least for me as someone who, you know, was there when the remake was announced and got excited about finally being able to play this story that everyone had talked about so much. Now that I know the reality of that is that the game is going to be split over three different games and over the course of, what, let's say it was 4 years from announcement to release, then it was another 4 years between the first part and this part, and let's say there's another 4 years. That's like 12 years. It feels like a big investment. It's not the sort of instant gratification I suppose I was expecting from being able to finally experience this universe. Now it's this epic saga that's going to take such a big chunk of my life, and I wonder whether that's going to impact the momentum of the remake project as a whole, or whether that changes people's opinions on it, because it kind of changes mine and it kind of sets my expectations differently. It's just it's an ambitious thing to do, but it's almost like an untested thing to do. I can't remember ever having a remake project span this massive amount of time when all things are considered.
No, well, no game's ever meant as much to a publisher as Final Fantasy VII to Square Enix. Like, it's the game that made them global. Like, people love VI, but VII was, like, industry-changing. And it's like, they put it off for so long, the idea of revisiting this thing. And now they've got this big three-game project. Like, Advent Children's back in cinemas for a little bit. Like, they've got all this stuff where it's, like I said, Ever Crisis is the gacha game and everything. And it's just, we know how money-grubby Square Enix are and how bad they are at cooking the books. Like, they lean so much on Final Fantasy to make up the cost, the amount of money that they lose on things. And I forget the name of their new president, but he is all in on monetization and, like, you know, putting as many of those predatory methods into games as possible. The way he talks seems to be that he would like to do more of that.
Yeah.
And I kind of fear for the idea of, at the heart of it, just this nice little RPG that was released in 1997 or whatever that a lot of people love, not sustaining an entire company for, like, almost 10 years, like you said. It's a weird reality to do it this way. But we'll see what happens with it. Question from Amy Rapier, who says, who is your favorite ever gaming news editor? Answer very carefully. Is she outside? Has she got a laser trained on her? Well, answer very carefully, guys.
Nobody else has ever made our head mugs when we're doing a little mug pun, so it's got to be Amy Rapier. I had a dream about Amy the other night that I was chasing her around Newcastle trying to give her a Sprite because I owed her a Sprite and I couldn't find her. So
she's running around Newcastle hoping that you turn a corner and she'd be right there.
That's pretty much it. Being like, oh, I've got this Sprite that you left me. Here is it. Dreams are weird, man. Dreams are strange.
They are a bit. Shout out to Amy Rapier, though. Massive love to you, fam. Hope you're doing very well. Question from Jack Asbury, who says, UBP, UBP, UBP. We've been spoiled recently by the quality of the podcast going out over the last few weeks. I'm just wondering how you guys decide what to talk about each week or week on week, especially in quiet news cycles. Keep on going, lads. The quality is superb. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Whatever comes to mind, to be honest. It's rare that we plan more than the day itself, but I don't know if you had any thoughts on this.
I think, you know, sometimes we initially tried to do news every day, videos every day. I remember when we tried to put that into practice and we realized that there was never just enough news to do it like every day reliably. Like, there was always stuff happening, but never something big enough to kind of justify its own video. So when we moved to three podcasts a week, I remember, even though I'm only in two of them, of course, apart from when Jules is doing a business, I remember thinking, like, how are we going to be able to fill that time long term? And yet, weirdly, it actually comes strangely naturally. I think we have way more freedom with the podcast than we do on videos in terms of not having to justify them as much in terms of, you know, views or finding a new story that's big enough. So I actually think it's become like a really cool space to talk about those new stories, smaller new stories alongside the bigger ones that otherwise maybe wouldn't be able to get their dedicated video, or talk about games that we maybe wouldn't have enough time to make a video on and then discuss them here because they're not as well known or whatever. So I think the YouTube side of it and the podcast side actually kind of balance themselves out quite nicely. I don't know how you think about that, Scott, but obviously, you know, you've got the UBP, that's a community-driven podcast, so we're very fortunate, I'm sure you would agree, to have so many cool people like yourself, Jack, like everyone else who's asked a question today that we might not get to, you know, to have that support, have those questions coming in. You know, we've got yourself and I, Scott, who are always playing things, so we've got that Monday slot covered because there's usually something we've been playing we want to talk about alongside the news. And then the Wednesday podcast kind of works as a legacy podcast in a way where we take more sometimes timeless topics or questions and try to answer them, or, you know, do a big spoiler cast on a newly released game and go an hour and a half. So there's always enough, I think. And I think enough, more importantly, perhaps, enough enthusiasm for everyone doing it. Not just me, you, Jules, but, you know, like I said the other week, Ewan, Stevie, Strawn, Cy, anyone else who kind of wants to jump in, Dan, Joe, like everyone has all of these ideas, and it's just, there's a lot of enthusiasm for the podcast, which makes it surprisingly easy to do, I find.
Yeah, man, the best thing I always loved about podcasts is that it's the conversations we already have anyway. How many times every day are we like, we should save this for the podcast? Like, if we're playing something, if we're keeping up with the gaming news, like, it just is what we would be talking about anyway. And I always think the best podcasts are the ones where it feels like that. It should feel like a natural conversation. It should feel like the thing that the people want to talk about. And like, yeah, sometimes there are, like, certain things that work better, like, as little packages on... Like, YouTube is such a weird beast. Like, it's something that we've obviously been with since, like, 2012, 2013-ish when the channel started. And you get used to what will kind of work as like a more sharp, like punchier thing on YouTube. I really liked actually the response to the little chunks that we put out, the discussion videos on PlayStation and Xbox that went out like last week or earlier this week. One of the two, time's a flat circle. But still, they did really, really well. And that was like a longer form thing. And like YouTube's kind of morphing into longer form stuff anyway. Like you might have seen us doing some compilation videos and longer stuff because that just is what people are responding to. And like YouTube wants to put more stuff on TV and everything. But like it is still like, it is like a beast to wrangle. And like, there's a way to do a YouTube video that is like fundamentally different to a discussion. Like there's a more natural approach to conversation that just suits podcasts. And I think me and you, it's like I said, it's the conversation we would be having anyway. And so I always love that. But yeah, in terms of like choosing what to go for, it's just, I mean, there is like there's a knack to it, like in terms of something, okay, this is a big enough story, this is worth doing a video on, this is worth dissecting in a podcast. And then we kind of just keep that middle slot as like, yeah, like a spoiler cast or like a general middle thing. That's been going for the longest time. Like when the podcast started, it was like almost more philosophical stuff I thought of. I was just like, in terms of the angle for it, I was just like, you know, certain approaches to level design or why we hate difficulty or love difficulty or whatever. A lot of those older ones were like that. And then, over time, we like settled into this 3 a week thing, and then they have their own different approaches. So like, it's kind of just what feels natural, and then going off people's responses. Like we can see the amount of listens for things. Spoiler casts are always something where a fraction of the audience are going to have played that game. Yeah. But it's a conversation we would have had anyway. So rather than do it on our lunch break, we'll do it for the podcast.
That's it, right? And I like that. This gives us, I remember the first time I thought, okay, this podcast is a lovely little corner that we have for ourselves. It was when we did, I think it was an entire podcast on 12 minutes. Can you remember that game?
Oh, yeah.
Like that dropped a few years ago. And we did like, we managed to go like, I don't know, quite long on just that one game. And we did like a deep dive into it. And that was when I thought, yeah, I love doing the pods because it gives us the opportunity to do that without necessarily the added pressure of, oh, is this going to do as well to justify it? Like, am I going to have to, to kind of like pitch this or anything? Like we have a little bit more freedom in that regard. And even without that, like you were saying, on the Monday podcast especially, I just use that as a catch-up with you. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, what's Scott been playing? What's Scott been up to? How's he feeling? What's the crack, you know? Sometimes I even forget that it actually goes out to people and people enjoy that as well because I enjoy it a lot. But I love the wind-up one. The only...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite
of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
Not issue, not certainly not argument, but the only time it becomes difficult for me personally to choose a topic when we're kind of like, you know, discussing what to cover that week is I'm often in my head about repeating myself. Mm. You know, we do so much content. We do 3 podcasts a week. We do the news. We do chatty faces. We do lists. We do all of this stuff. And I think the only time that I recall that I've ever pushed back against something that you've suggested, for instance, is when I've gone, oh, I don't want to repeat myself. You know what I mean? I feel like I've already said everything I've had to say about that topic or that subject or whatever. But I think we do a good job of hopefully trying to avoid that. And I have to kind of remind myself that, yeah, of course, not everyone listens to every single podcast. So, you know, you have to repeat yourself to a certain degree. But I'm aware of that. And I'm trying to... make it so that I don't repeat myself as much, so if people aren't just hearing the same opinions over and over again, because I don't want to be that guy at a party who just relays the same stories every single time you see them. So hopefully it maintains a bit of freshness. I hope.
Yeah, man, I know what you mean. Well, we've tried to do like a new kind of approach to stuff where it's like, if it's multiple things that we would talk about and they can work as a news, we'll just do them as like a long form thing and we'll record it in the podcast studio, chop it up, put that out on YouTube. So that is the one conversation. Whereas in the past, we would be thinking of the platform mentality and be like, okay, YouTube is looking for this, so we'll package it this way. And then a podcast is going to be more like this, but we really want to pick this particular subject matter apart twice. So we'll do the YouTube version and then the podcast version, and you can't help but have some overlap. It's just the reality of working in this business over time and like the weird way that different platforms dominate over time. But like, yeah, we always know what's worth kind of covering ourselves because we've just been doing this for so long. Like, I'm in my 11th year. I think you're in like your 9th year or something.
Yeah,
like we've been going a long time, especially in this particular line of work. It is rare to have a working relationship, like a creative relationship, for that long. And so at some point you just kind of know what's worth covering. Question from Josh Sloan, who says, great to have Josh back, curious to hear his thoughts on how games can positively or negatively impact mental health.
That's a good question.
It's a meaty question, isn't it?
From a fellow Josh as well. You love to see it.
I tell you what, you summoned all the Joshes. We've got a whole bunch of Joshes in
really?
The question. Shout out to the Joshes.
Well, first off, thank you for your very kind words at the start of there. And thank everyone else. I had a quick blast over some of the questions this morning, and they were all very nice to you saying things like, oh, welcome back, Josh. I'm rambling now. I'm embarrassed. I'm very embarrassed by it.
He's a lovely, lovely man, and I'm loving having him back.
Thank you yet again. No, it's an interesting question, that, because it's actually one that I was thinking about a lot last year for obvious reasons, you know, because for the longest time, I've mentioned this on podcasts that we did over the pandemic especially, you know, video games for me can be a huge boost to my mental health because they're the only piece of art, or they're the only hobby that I can do personally that engages all of my brain in a way that I find completely distracting from life, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
For instance, if I'm watching a movie while I'm having a bad mental health period, if I'm watching a TV show, if I'm trying to read a book, or sometimes even listen to music, I'm not even really engaging with what I've got on because I'm still preoccupied with my own thoughts, for instance. But gaming for me is a way to kind of, for a small amount of time, give my brain totally over to something else. You know, if I'm playing Call of Duty Warzone, I'm not thinking about Call of Duty Warzone and, you know, the regrets that I have in life. You know what I mean? It's all Call of Duty Warzone. It's all about killing that guy. It's all about where am I going to drop next. So in that respect, games have been a big help for me, but at the same time, I've started to notice like an almost double-edgedness to that, because over the past year, I kind of realized I was using that escape for me personally a little bit too much, and I was leaning on it a little bit too much to the negligence of my own health or my own responsibilities, you know? I remember the first 2 weeks that I had off from What Culture, Starfield was out, and I played essentially 80 hours of Starfield across that like week and a half period, to the point where I was like, I was getting up, I was just playing it all day through to like 3 in the morning, getting no sleep, you know, not really looking after myself. And it was because I, as much as I was enjoying the game, I didn't want to think about, oh, you're off, you need to do some stuff. You know, this is your opportunity to go to the doctors. You need to make some progress on yourself. You know what I mean? The pressure of that was so overwhelming that I kind of lost myself in Starfield in that regard. And I've done that a few times over the years where I've just, to the detriment sometimes of, like I said, my routine or health or whatever, have just like thrown myself into a game in a way that I do think is a little bit unhealthy. So I've been trying to manage that over the past few months and whatnot. And that's been interesting, because I used to view games as like this lovely escape, and now I'm realizing that I'm almost using that in a vice-like way, as if, like, I don't want to compare it to, you know, alcohol or whatever, but if I'd used that in the past, like going out with my friends, drinking a lot, you know, it kind of, in a strange way, had a similar impact on me as that. So yeah, I think games can be both good, but for me personally, this might not be reflective of anyone else. I have to be aware of how much I'm indulging in them as a, what would I describe it, as a almost piece of medication. You know, if I'm viewing them in that lens, it can become a little bit dangerous for me personally, honestly.
Yeah, man. The way you put that with the, because I've always thought of the distinction between like passive entertainment and active entertainment. It's why I always preferred, overall, I'll take a video game over a TV show, a movie, whatever else, because I am fully invested in it. But the way you phrase that like completely crystallizes my thoughts on it. And I love that we have that term of like, oh, you want to get in like a bubble with something, you're bubbling with a certain franchise, I'm going to play all of it in one big go. But it's true, like it is too easy. Obviously, video games, especially now, are designed to keep your attention. Like we talk so much about like gameplay loops and the addictive nature of them, and it's like rooting you to the spot, one more level, one more run, whatever it is. And like, yeah, like you need to be aware of that other side of it, which I think like Only when you get a bit older and you've lived with video games for this long and you do the self-reflection and you think back on the various games that you did put that much time into, that you realize the negative side of it, even though at the time it was completely what was right for you at the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, I definitely think back on that stuff. And like, I very much, I think me and you have talked about it. Maybe I talked about it with Jules or something. But I was bullied loads in first school and middle school. Like, I mean, I always had friends, always had a social circle, but for whatever reason, it was just having to deal with bullies and everything. And I always thought that was why I escaped to video games so much. Because they give you agency, they give you power in scenarios, they give you meaning and purpose and agency and everything. And I always thought that was, only retrospectively did I think about that as I got older, where I was like, I needed all that stuff. People always talk about albums that got them through high school, or certain lyrics, certain messagings, thematics, whatever it is that they resonated with. And I think mine was just being able to get a level of agency that I didn't feel I had in real life. So I think that is a huge positive. But it is always worth knowing when you've sat for too long, knowing when you're pushing off the putting off life's responsibilities. I always kind of, I'm a big balance guy. Yeah. I love a yin yang symbol. I always have, and I love all that stuff. So it's like, if I'm gonna dedicate the day to sitting and playing a game, I better make sure everything else is in line first, or I better take a break and make sure all that stuff is in line. And it can be as simple as just making sure the dishes are done.
Yeah,
but it does
yeah.
mean that your overall, that your surroundings are as most in balance as they can be.
I think the word you use there, agency, is really important in terms of, I fully agree with that, you know. I hope that came through with what I was saying there, like that level of control you get over video games, the way it engages your brain in that way, it can be magic, you know. It can be incredible. It can be so useful, so affirming, and so genuinely life-saving in certain ways. But so I guess for me, it's like, I'm not saying that you can't have like days where you just spend 10 hours playing a game. Like, I've done that. It's been incredible. It's been exactly what I needed. I'm starting to slowly realize that there's like a distinction between those days where I can just, you know, leave all my responsibilities behind, spend 10 hours blasting through an RPG and having a really relaxing, reinvigorating rest day, compared to the days where I'm doing that exact same thing for potentially the wrong reasons, to ignore the stuff that's I should be addressing, or doing that to then wake up the next day and put myself in almost a disadvantage because I've not had any food, or I've not done the dishes, you know what I mean. I've ignored my life to like the detriment of it. It's a real fine line, and one that I actually wasn't very aware of until this past year, where I started thinking about it and interrogating why I was playing stuff. But it's interesting, and obviously it's going to change for everyone. But yeah, that's my experience with it anyway.
Yeah, man, I would only echo that. I think as well on my side, like obviously like learning I'm going to be a dad is like a huge thing. That's very much like helped separate a lot of the what's worth putting my time into, my energy into, how much I'm distracting myself with video games, how much of my life is video games. Like, shout out to Tom Talks Rubbish, who's a YouTube channel, and we did a couple of interviews with him. And I remember him asking me, like, oh, have you ever taken a break from video games, like, across your entire life? And no one's ever asked me that before. But the answer was no. I was like, no, I've always just gone hard with video games. Like I said, it was very much born out of all the bullying stuff and how I felt when I was younger and everything. But, like, diving into the Master System and then Mega Drive and then everything from then on in, I always loved it. I've never really given it up. It's always the thing that I go to every day for hours and hours and hours. But not in like a toxic avoiding the world way, but it just is the thing I do. Like, it just is. It's one of the things I do. I was going to say, like, alongside playing guitar, watching movies, you know, whatever. Having a wife, but still, like, you know, having a good life alongside. But it is that balance thing. And, like, really realizing I'm going to be a dad and being like, okay, that's going to impact a lot of stuff. But I'm so ready for it. That realization, like, I felt my my child kick last week for the first time. That was one of the best feelings in the world. Like, that is indescribably life-affirming, and like, no, this is what matters.
Yeah.
Like, this is the thing. This is what you want. This is what it's supposed to feel like to be human. And I'm like, okay, cool, I get it. Like, you know, he's knocking, he's ready to come out. I get it. And it's moments like that that I think you kind of do need that separation thing of like realizing that getting lost in another world, in an escapist art form for a day is like a tool to help you with the bigger stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it's using it that way. I think that's almost the end game, or the ultimate point of the balance side of it anyway.
No, that's a great point. I can only echo that for sure. Like, it can be great, but it can only ever be like a band-aid. It can only ever be like a plaster. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not going to be like a permanent solution. It's a nice little almost cold and flu tablet when you're feeling like a little bit poorly, but it's not gonna, you know, like fix the core issues. And like, if you're lean on it too much like I did, definitely it can be.
I think we all, I mean, I definitely did too. I think everybody does. It's very easy to do that. I wanted to shout out, I always remember the dude's surname, it's Shabilsky, but I think it's Andre Shabilsky, did a whole breakdown of gameplay loops. I remember the first time I read that, I did a whole university thing on it. It was more than 10 years ago, but I loved that realization of like, oh, okay, I get how these addictive loops work. There's a whole thing about how different games have various loops at the same time. Some of them take longer to close. Some of them have smaller ones within that loop. And like, that's how we get satisfaction out of video games. And there is a whole philosophy, psychological element to that.
Yeah.
That once you're aware of it, you can see it really overtly with Suicide Squad because they're literally visualizing it. But some games are more subtle with it, and that doesn't necessarily mean they're bad, but it's being aware of the way you're being played as well. To kind of make it cheesy, but that literally is what it is.
No, it is. And you know, it's not just video games. There's a bunch of other things in our, you know, modern world, like your phone, for instance. You know, I turned off social media while I was away, and it was so strangely relieving to not just find myself. It wasn't that I was like looking at things that were like making me sad or anything. It was just like the habits that I'd gotten myself into. Like, why was I spending so much of the day just clicking Twitter, not even reading anything, and just like scrolling down to see if there were any new posts? I remember Michael Hamflett used to describe Twitter as like the ultimate slot machine. Like, you go on, you scroll your thumb down, you look at the little thing loading, and you're like, what am I going to get? Is it going to be a jackpot? Is it going to be nothing? And I thought, that is such a strange habit to get in, and I became so aware of it that I was, you know, I'm not doing it perfectly. I still go on Twitter now and again to just see what's happening. Did it a lot when Big Brother was on, to be honest. Like to keep up with the discourse of that. But
you want to watch The Traitors, mate. That's what you want to watch. BBC's The Traitors. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I do. I really do. I really want to watch The Traitors. But yeah, it was just another thing where I'm like, oh, okay, I'm noticing these habits and trying to interrogate, why am I doing them? What am I getting from that? Like, is that a productive use of my time? And why have I been conditioned to think that is something I need to do every 5 minutes, you know? So it's definitely those, it's not just in games, but it's sort of like the psychology of the modern times.
Yeah, well, I love all that stuff. Like, give me all the psychological, philosophical conversations. Like, I love all that stuff, why we think the way we do, like different, you know, habits that you can get into, different thought processes and whatever. Yeah, I think it's just to round that out on social media, I think the key, for me, the key word's been curation. Like, just saying, show me less of this, show me more of this. I'll like this thing, I'll not even interact with this other thing. And just curating your feed, because I think if you leave it up to the algorithms, they will just barf all over you. You will get the worst possible stuff because negativity does engage. Again, that's the YouTube is a beast thing. Or you can delve into the human side of it. I remember, it's such a weird tangent, delving into that when I did a whole thesis thing in university on like violence in video games. Why do we like playable violence, interactive violence, and delving into like gladiators and coliseums and watching people actually get killed and like when hangings were a thing. And it's like, there's a weird thing in humans with viscera, and there's a weird connection to blood, gore, and guts and everything that's inside us. And there's a thing there that is weirdly alluring to a lot of people, especially when you then make it playable and then you calibrate a video game to make that satisfying. There's something there that is inherently engaging. And it's like, that's like a fascinating thing. We kind of are drawn to like the macabre in a way. And I think like some of that comes through in the social media stuff. Like, look at this effed up thing that you would never have seen unless you let an algorithm serve you it up. It's like, you kind of need to be on that and be like, I'm going to curate this so I don't see the horrible thing that I would never want to have seen in the first place. So there's a lot of that. Question from Josh Youngman. Another Josh, my friend. Coming all the way in. It's great to hear Josh back on the pods. It's great to hear all the Joshes out there.
Thank you.
2024 is a great year for both of you. I want to ask what your favorite song from last year was. Mine was Boy Genius's cover of You're Still the One from their live lounge. That's a pick. That is a pick, my friend.
What a pick. I was listening to that last night after I got in from the cinema. What a shout. That is great.
Shout.
You know what? It's a difficult one. While we speak, I'm going to get me top songs up on Spotify because...
See, if we're talking last year's music while you bring that up, it's entirely Sleep Token for me. I couldn't escape just playing Sleep Token's album over and over and over again. Specifically, it was The Summoning. That was the first single off that album. That was the one that got me like massively into them. I already had listened to the previous two albums, but like a lot of people kind of like realized Sleep Token was it. And it was like, okay, these guys are like doing something that is such a mix of like sludgy metal and like trap beats. And then like there's just everything is in there. And I absolutely adore Sleep Token. I haven't seen them live yet, but they were brilliant. I would like shout out like Bring Me the Horizon. I saw Bring Me the Horizon live the other night. And they did like their new singles. They had like a year of singles last year where it was like Lost. And I think Dark Side was last year as well. So they would be up there too. But I think if I was going to just shout out a single song, it's The Summoning by Sleep Token. And if you haven't heard it, go check out that song.
I need to get into them, man, because you played them quite often in the office last year, but obviously not necessarily the environment to properly take in the music. And then at the end of the year, I got a message from my trusted music advisor, Adam Nicholas, who said like...
he discovered them last year as well.
He said, I finally got into the Sleep Token business and it absolutely rules. So I need to give them a go for sure.
Super quick, when he messaged me and he was like, I know you're a fan of this band. He's like, let's talk about Sleep Token. I was like, I couldn't have got a better message all year long for them, other than realizing I'm going to be a dad, but near enough. It was like, let's talk about Sleep Token. Sometimes they take a little while to click. Vessel, the lead dude's vocals are a little bit, not what you'd expect from like a metal-tinged band or a band described as hard rock or heavy metal or whatever. And it's not like they are that genre entirely. They're very much their own thing. But I would say check out their most recent album. I would say just check out The Summoning. That has everything that they do in one song. It's awesome.
I'm going to steal Josh's idea because I think maybe, if not my favorite album of last year, but the one I listened to the most was definitely the Boy Genius The Record LP. And the song Cool About It, I think, was definitely the song of 2023 for me. I thought that was like an incredible, just melodic, touching little song that perfectly encapsulates what Boy Genius is all about. I love the last verse. I think it's Phoebe Bridges where she's talking about, she's thinking about like walking home with someone and like choosing to not ask them about what's really going on with them. And it's almost like she says, you know, like that she's practicing method acting by doing it because they both know something's wrong, but they both kind of subtly agree to not acknowledge it and that's going to be fine, but they're still worrying about each other and whatnot. That just whole song is great. I loved their Spanish Love Songs had an excellent album last year. I love the song Clean Up Crew. That was on repeat all the time. Strange Weather by Slaughter Beach Dog. Absolutely excellent. And probably A&W off the new Lana Del Rey album, which I loved in totality. I thought that was a great song. I loved the Grants off there. There were a lot there was a lot of good music last year, Scott. I know that's much more than one, but those are the ones that come to mind because I normally do every year like my top songs, but I didn't this year, so I've just had to rely on the old Spotify rap there. But those are definitely ones that defined my 2023.
Mm-hmm. It was funny when Spotify did their rap thing and it was like, it's all Sleep Token. Like my top five was just, here's five songs of the Sleep Token album. Even though I do try and listen to a quite a wide variety of stuff. For me, it's definitely just going to be Sleep Token all the way. Question from Bam, who says, good day, lads. Loving the healthy helping of Josh Brown since his triumphant return. Which game currently stuck in development hell do you think is never actually releasing? Also, if you could choose one, which cancelled game would you resurrect?
Ooh.
I have immediate stuff for this.
Yeah, go on.
Game stuck in development hell that's never actually releasing, Perfect Dark. The stories about that thing restarting development like four times, loads of the team have left. I forget who wrote up the most recent report saying it's like 20 people trying to make that thing work. And it seems I should probably clarify if people don't know, Perfect Dark was an N64 game. They're rebooting it. It's an Xbox exclusive. And a new studio was made to try and get that thing over the finish line. And apparently it's been very hard to nail down what the playability of that game, the way it's going to play. It was a first-person franchise back in the day. And same with the Perfect Dark follow-up on Xbox 360. But apparently it's very hard to make that thing work. So my shout would be Perfect Dark. And then in terms of a cancelled game I'd resurrect, the Legacy of Kain game we never got, Dead Sun.
Oh, yeah.
Just because I think that would have at least kept the franchise going in a way that Nosgoth didn't. And I love Legacy of Kain. And it's like, I would only want it if Amy Hennig or the other core creatives wanted to do it. But Dead Sun had some really cool gameplay ideas using the whole dual world thing, reality and the spirit realm and everything. And I just think Legacy of Kain should be a fixture of our lives in the way that, like, even Castlevania is over on Netflix. Like, it still gets mentioned. Legacy of Kain doesn't get anything.
No, that's true. Yeah, like, I feel like there's such that sort of cult following around it. But yeah, it sort of hasn't translated in the same way that a few of the franchises from that, and obviously Castlevania probably precedes it by a little bit, but you know what I mean, from like that time, it's just sort of, it doesn't deserve to stay dead, Scott Ilford, is what I'm trying to say there. And for me, I don't think Beyond Good and Evil is ever coming out. That game, just cancel it, man. Get rid of it.
But they got the remake coming out soon, which usually only do that to remind you of the future one.
There's just no way, man. There is no way. Like, if you couldn't cancel Skull and Bones because you allegedly had an agreement with the Singapore government, it makes me think, which government do you have an agreement with to keep Beyond Good and Evil going? Because I don't understand why that has not been cancelled. When was that thing first announced? Like 2008 or something?
Beyond Good and Evil 2 was very first mentioned. Well, the original 2004, and I think it was an E3 2007, 2008 when they said they were doing a sequel.
Yeah.
And then it went away for like 10 years, and then it was mentioned during the Vivendi takeover when they had to say they had all these projects in the works to not get taken over, so they revitalized it. And then it wasn't Patrice Desilet, I forget the name of the dude, the creator of Rayman, the creator of Beyond Good and Evil, who left Ubisoft, and he's not even involved in the sequel anymore.
Yeah.
And it's like, what even is this?
That game's been in development for literally half my life. You know what I mean? I don't ever expect to see it coming out in my lifetime. And let's just call it quits at this point. You know, I often think that at a certain point, like, the fan base for that sequel has just kind of gone. You've missed the moment. Like, you could make Beyond Good and Evil 2 a thing if you tried really hard and had an excellent game. But no one's clamoring for it, I don't think, in the same way that they were in the late 2000s. You know what I mean? Like, so much time has passed since then that I just think I can't see that game ever coming out. One that I would like to resurrect, though, is a recent one. It's The Last of Us Factions. I just would have liked to have played whatever they had made so far. I loved the multiplayer factions from The Last of Us 1, and as you know, I'm a huge fan of the gameplay from The Last of Us 2, so even if they didn't finish it, like, even if they could have just cut up the map that they made and, you know, made a regular multiplayer mode, I just want to play, you know, it might sound sacrilegious, I just want to play multiplayer Last of Us, because I thought that was such an underrated thing that we got to experience, and the fact that they didn't remake the original factions for the Part 1 redo now stings even more, because it just means that part of The Last of Us's history is kind of dead.
Well, it was like a weird thing where they were like, yeah, Last of Us Factions, the PS3 one, was awesome. I really liked that as well. Like, a big part of that at the time, or I guess when people think about it, is the social media crossover, because way more people were on Facebook or whatever back then. So then your actual friends list were the people that were being mentioned in the game, because it would all sync over. And I guess they couldn't necessarily make that work now. But yeah, like, I liked the gameplay enough of that back in the day. I think that the no return mode is a nice little nod to what that kind of feels like a different style of Last of Us combat. But the idea of doing multiplayer stuff, I guess that is just done for now. But it's like Naughty Dog, I was just thinking, like, Naughty Dog low-key do nice little multiplayer modes. I really liked Uncharted 2 and 3's multiplayer. Uncharted 4 brought all those weird special powers in that was not fully what I was there for, but the idea of, like, in Uncharted's case, like a 3D platformer with guns as a multiplayer game is cool, like getting the drop on someone by going around them and climbing up and stuff. It's like, I want more of that, more traversal in shooters. Like, you don't really get that very much unless it's like Titanfall, you're running on the walls or something. I guess the finals, but you still have to like detonate bring someone down. You're not really able to climb around as much as you would want to.
Yeah.
But yeah, question from Ben Petit, who says, what is the longest amount of time you've invested in a game before giving up on it? It took me 70 hours into Dragon Quest XI to realize I was wasting my time. Also, Steve says, gentlemen, I've reached 1,000+ hours in Elden Ring. I regret nothing. Game rules. Haven't had the same experience. I just want to talk about our time. My go-to for anything that I put the most time into and still didn't finish is Persona 5. I'm like 90+ hours. It just won't end. I've been playing it since 2017.
Dude,
there's been 3 generations of What Culture presenters since then. I can't finish it.
You've been playing that literally since I started working for this company. It was one of the first games you were playing, and you were telling me how you played like 60 or 70 hours back then. That is hilarious. That spanned my entire 10-year at this company. That
I reinstall it every now and then and be like, I'll do a little bit more. Maybe I'll finish it. I'll do a little bit more. I love everything about it, other than how bad hardly paced it is, and I can't help but compare it to Persona 4, which had just a way better story. And it's like Persona 5, I'm not going to go on about it, I've done it for how long, 7 years, but I'm in a space station near the end, and then when I look at the level list, I'm not actually near the end, and I'm like 90 hours, and I'm like, oh, just let it be over.
You know, for me, every time I put that amount of time into a game, I always eventually do go back and finish it. So I don't think I have one that I've just outright abandoned. I have a few that I've begrudgingly finished. Assassin's Creed Valhalla definitely is up there. I remember
Days
playing...
Gone was one of your big ones.
That's it, man. I think Valhalla just pips it at the post because that was about 70 hours. And then I thought, I want this to be over, but I can't invest this amount of time and just call it quits. So I begrudgingly got to the end of that game. There was another one that I was just thinking of as well. That
I remember you stopping playing Far Cry 6, I think, but I didn't know how much time you put into that.
Yeah, that's actually one that I have just abandoned. Good point, I think. actually, no, you've sparked a memory there. There are a few Ubisoft ones that I just did call it quits on after about 15 or 20 hours. Far Cry 6, that was about 15 hours that I just thought, I can't. I deserve more than this. My time is worth more. So I had to trade that in to get it away from me. Watch Dogs 2 I abandoned, but not because I hated it. I really enjoyed that game. It was just a case of I must have put it down over a Christmas period or something and just never got back to it. I've always wanted to go back and finish that game because I was right at the end. There is another... Oh, Dragon Age Inquisition. Was one that I put, again, about 70, 80 hours in. Didn't finish. Dropped it for about 6 months and then eventually thought, I need to see this out. I need to see what happens at the end. So I always have this perhaps stupid anecdote from that game where in a game called Dragon Age Inquisition, I killed a single dragon. I had one dragon fight and then I didn't do any of that extra stuff. So I just, there was a certain point in that game, even though, again, I quite liked it. I just wanted to get it over.
Yeah, I used to have that where I wanted to make sure every single thing was done. I'm still trying to finish as many games as possible, but there are some things, like you have with Far Cry or Ubisoft stuff, where you're just too aware of the design, you're too aware of how much your time is being manipulated, and over time, as you get older, your time is... I'm not saying your time is worth less when you're younger, but you're more aware of the amount of things you could be doing. And I think at some point, I just had to be like, nah, this is I can do a million other things. I can go for a walk. I can do anything at all other than this. And I think it sometimes gets it's easier to break away. It's healthier. We talked about health before.
Yeah.
It's healthier to break away from something that is just a spreadsheet of game loops, where it's just, if it's spreadsheet game design, get it in the bin.
Yeah,
unless
I agree.
Specifically enjoying it. Question from Coach Marv, who says, a yearly quota of games which is smaller than ideal but ensures 99% are great quality and as advertised day one, or as it is today with endless releases but no game is ever patched and stays as it is from day one. Quantity versus supposedly guaranteed quality, which would you prefer?
Quality, man. Gotta be quality. Like, as much as I loved something like Jedi Survivor last year, I don't want a year full of Jedi Survivors that are great games but that don't work. So, and to be honest, you know, we've talked about this again before, but in terms of game length these days, I could take fewer games. You know, I'm actually really enjoying that January and February, for me at least, doesn't have that many big releases, so I get to play Baldur's Gate 3 without the pressure of knowing that there's another 5 games around the corner. You know what I mean? I've got plenty of games to get through.
Knocking on your window last night with another copy of Prince of Persia, but you didn't answer. I don't... how many more nights can I try this? Prince of Persia, Lost Crown.
Sorry, mate. Right, I've got Avatar Frontiers of Pandora to play next. So
you'll have to speak up. I'm playing Avatar Frontiers of Pandora.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I've got Avatar literally waiting to play, which I genuinely am excited about. I've got Mortal Kombat 1 in my cupboard. To jump into as well. So I'd take a little spread out calendar, personally.
Which is, I would, as my answer to the question, I would take the quality thing. My business cynical brain goes to the fact that most of the studios would then have to ensure that the quota of games they are releasing would be stuffed full of monetization and predatory stuff and everything else to recoup the funds necessary to do that. However, you would hope there would be some sort of reckoning where the amount of money you can spend on a game gets brought down so you can actually fulfill that stuff. But you'd never get that because they can't just be happy. They've got to keep growing. They've got to keep doing more. Make the numbers go up. We can't just make video games. I would still take quality overall though. My thing with all the games that are coming out is I've got Prince of Persia right now, which I'm trying to squeeze in the next few days. Then Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth is out, which is going to be a 100 plus hour game. So I'll do that. And then I've got Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which will be straight after that. It's like, they're all like days and weeks apart. So I'm back in it.
This is funny because it's kind of like the inverse of 2023 for us, where I had like a bunch of games where I was just telling you, you know, Scott, I've been up all night. This game is amazing. It's 5-star. And you were like, yeah, it's all right. I'm not too arsed about it. I'll wait for something that engages me. We've kind of done that this year where you've got Prince of Persia, you've got like a dragon, like you said, and then, of course, I'll be playing Final Fantasy, but you've got off to quite a good start, actually, with those games in mind.
Honestly, dude, I mean, we tried to, and I made you do a video on Prince of Persia, because I need someone to just sit with me and just talk about how awesome Prince of Persia is. That game's beautiful. It even runs really well on the Switch. It's got like cross saves. I almost bought another copy of it. I bought the deluxe edition on Switch because I was like, look, Ubisoft, I'm going to support the good stuff. Here's 50 English pounds towards this game. And then for a second, when it said it had crossplay, I was like, do I get it on PS5 as well? I can play it on the train and I can come home and I can keep going on the PS5. And they'll have £100 towards this beautiful endeavor. But I'm going to see how it's selling. If it needs a boost in the sales once they reveal the weekend numbers, then maybe I'll blow my wage on it. I'll get you a copy. I don't care.
Yeah.
I just
give
want to support this game.
A cheeky Tailford 50, as it's known around these parts.
The Tail 50. We'll see how it goes. Final question from Jaunty Bagend, possibly the best name we've ever had on the podcast, Jaunty, who says, I'd love to get your thoughts in games adapted from movies or TV. Do you think these can ever be done exceptionally well? I'm currently riding the new indie game hype. Now, I put this in here because me and you had a hilarious exchange after the Xbox Direct last night. And I thought we'd talk a little bit about the Indiana Jones game. Bit of a mixed response, mostly positive online, but
listen,
that did not involve Josh Brown.
If I speak, I am in big trouble, is all I will say about the Indiana Jones game. No, it's it's a real mixed bag for me. I was really down on it, truth be told, and I don't like to be down on games, as you know. But watching the reveal for that, I felt very cynical about it. Like, I thought there were parts of it that looked really interesting. I like the mechanics that they're implementing with the whip. I thought that did look really cool. You know, the locations look really nice. But just the way they were talking about it, you know, when they were selling us, in my opinion, on brand new gaming features like the ability to either stealth your way through a level or fight your way through a level. I just thought that was a selling point of Wolfenstein The New Order in 2014. Like, is that
the stealth was pretty crap in that game.
It was, yeah. And I was just thinking, like, is that all we've got this time around, you know? I thought visually, the art design of it didn't do much for me personally. I know they're not going necessarily for photorealism, I don't think. It looks like the Wolfenstein engine, just like with a few tweaks. But I thought the faces looked a little bit off. I just didn't think it looked that next gen to me personally, and it just, yeah, it had a certain clunkiness to it that made me wonder how it's going to play, because I liked, you know, I loved the two Wolfenstein games that came out, and I loved the visceral nature of them, but as shooters, I never actually thought they struck the balance between playing to the game's strengths. Like, I'm not the only person to say this, but I almost wanted to play those games like they were Doom. You know what I mean? Because you get the ability to, like, dual-wield shotguns, but you're so fragile that the balance was never quite there. So I'm interested how they handle Indiana Jones, especially the switch between third person and first person. Like, I'm fine with it being first person, but the concessions they're making to, like, pull the camera out while he's climbing slowly up a drain pipe, like, that doesn't do anything for me. That, that is not
that
working
bit
for me.
The thing is, I love a first and third person hybrid when it's done well. And I think that coupled with solid cutscene direction, and in this case, it's Troy Baker's Harrison Ford's Indiana Jones. We'll get back to him in a sec.
Yeah.
I came away from this very, very, like, happy enough, but I was expecting nothing. I'm not necessarily an Indiana Jones fan. I didn't really grow up with them. Well, I didn't grow up with the movies. I didn't really love them when I finally got around to watching them as I was a bit older. My Indiana Jones is The Mummy. I like The Mummy 1 and 2.
Yes,
so, yeah. My Indiana Jones is Brendan Fraser's character, who I forget the name of now, but I liked him a lot. And so, like, I didn't really have the affinity for the IP. And so I kind of went into this going like, well, it's Todd Howard's idea. Apparently he went to Machine Games and said, I'd love to make an Indiana Jones game. I do love the Wolfenstein games, like you said. However, in Wolfie 2, I ended up knocking the difficulty down because it just felt so completely unfair. Like, all these, like, it just felt like you were being hit regardless of whether you were in cover or not. And I was like, I just want to be this Nazi murdering machine for a while. I'll just knock it down onto easy for a bit. And I had a blast with it. I think the best things in Wolfie 2 are the cutscenes, the messaging, the thematics, the way it interrogates parts of America's history and everything, or American mentalities. And so I went into Indiana Jones going like, this is like a weird little fun side thing where you can take the Nazi killing and you can apply it to one of the biggest Nazi killing franchises ever and just kind of have fun with it. And I quite liked how much of like a throwback it was to like a bygone era in terms of we're doing away with the new age monetary, you know, we're not worrying about rendering every little time the iris moves in the eye because there's a light change in the scene. I just want to punch some dudes and shoot them and play as a dude that looks like Harrison Ford. And sounds like him too, I would have said. But
I'll get to that in a second. I want to touch on what you just said there because, yeah, I can totally see that. You know, it's on Game Pass, so of course I'll jump in. I guess the only, I guess my biggest criticism is that if I didn't know it was Machine Games making it, I'd have been even harsher on that trailer. You know what I mean? It's only kind of through the goodwill that they've earned that I'm more optimistic than I perhaps would have been, because I do, like, I echo what you said there. Characterization across those two Wolfenstein games were great. The cutscene direction, excellent. You know, the pathos they managed to imbue into that world was great. The world building itself and art direction, awesome. I didn't get that from this trailer, but it's very early days. I liked the idea of the villain, you know, like the opening scene where Indiana Jones is like buried in the sand and he's getting talked at. I thought, right, okay, that looks very Indiana Jones in terms of tone and, you know, presentation and whatnot. But yeah, going
Tony
back
Todd's
to
in it as well. It's
Tony
like
Todd
playing like a good looking character. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, Tony Todd, I pop for him. I'm more excited for him than I am Troy Baker, by the way.
Ugh.
And this was maybe, I keep saying, this is maybe my biggest criticism. I have a lot of criticisms of the game, is the point.
Just go for it, mate.
But when, you know, I heard the voice actor for Indy, I thought, you're trying so hard to do a Harrison Ford impression and nail it that you're forgetting to emote or bring any charisma to the role. So on the surface, yeah, it sounds pretty good as Harrison Ford, but where's the energy? Where's the life to it? So when you told me, actually, I didn't even know this, you messaged me saying, like, that's Troy Baker. I couldn't believe it. Again, early days, but I couldn't believe that was Troy Baker doing that, because I just thought, where's the soul of it? I didn't get that from the first trailer, but again, I'm being very nitpicky, very harsh about it. It is only one trailer. We've got so many more reveals to go. I might and hope to be won round by it by the end, because I do want this game to be great. You never want a game to be bad, but yeah, if we're talking pure good instinct first impressions, it's made me wary.
I think for mine it was like I said, I went in with zero expectations. Like, I don't care about Indy, and like, I love the Wolfie games. I keep calling them Wolfie games because it's easier than saying Wolfenstein the New Colossus every time. I had a lot of fun with their game engines, and I remember thinking that, like, if you just kind of unleash this a little bit and just kind of have like a fun you know, a fun romp through various locations, then that'll be enough. And this is a weird thing, because I don't necessarily think you're saying this, but I think there is a conversation on the idea of, say you're a game studio and you're making a new game, and you aren't necessarily aiming for a specific era in gaming, but there is an assumption that if it can't hang with the Red Dead 2s, the Last of Us's, the upper echelon of what gaming can be, then it's not good enough. Like, I think there's a, like, I was messaging you about, we had this a little while ago, I can't think which game came out, and it was like, oh, it just looks like a PS2 platformer. And I was like, yeah, one of the greatest eras in gaming history. And two, that's completely fine to aim for that.
Yeah.
Like, we don't really have a go at, like, when a movie releases in black and white, it's a specific aesthetic choice. Or, like, if a certain budget is attached to a game. Like, to me, if I'm thinking of gaming as an art form, I'm thinking of the entirety of, like, 40 plus years of video games, then I'm going to be just as excited or curious about something that is aiming to be a throwback to an Atari game from the 70s as I am spending your entire budget rendering a face and doing Hellblade 2. Like, I'm there for the whole thing. And I don't necessarily, you're not saying this, but I think that's an interesting conversation, because I don't think we can hit those highs every time, or maybe ever. Red Dead 2 felt like such an anomaly.
Yeah.
And, like, as is clear from the budgets on the Sony side, I think they are increasingly anomalous too. Like, being able to get lifelike face, like facial animation and innovative gameplay mechanics and an open world or whatever it is. It just feels like overall where, like, petering out, or whatever the word is, like becoming more smooth with like the idea of like we're hitting bars in gaming as opposed to the same highest bar over and over and over again.
No,
and I don't necessarily mind a team doing like a what we would call an old school 360 era game. That just is the game.
I'm with you, apart from where you would place Indiana Jones from what we've seen so far. So I'm totally with you, man. Like, I love my throwback games. I did a whole editorial on Wanted Dead, and that is very much a love letter to those 360 games that you mentioned explicitly. You know, Kena Bridge of Spirits, I know you really enjoyed.
That's what it was.
Referenced as like, it's just a PS2 platformer, but that's cool to have back, you know? The issue I have with what I've seen of Indiana Jones is that it's sort of in a nostalgia no man's land. Like, if it was going for a 360 throwback, I would be there for it because we don't really get those anymore. My issue is that it's more of a PS4 throwback in terms of the mechanics that they were showing off. Like I said, that combination of stealth and action and whatever. Like, to me, it doesn't seem like an intentional throwback decision because that was what defined the last Wolfenstein game and the one before that. It just seems like a continuation of that to me, in a lack of innovation in that regard, rather than a conscious decision to go, okay, we're not going to try to chase trends or chase Red Dead. We're going to go back to the 360 era or the PS2 era and see what we can mine in an old school way. It just seems dated in an unintentional way to me.
I can see that. I think, like, from what they showed off, other than the whip stuff, it isn't very innovative. And even the whip things, like, we've seen games do that, you know, before. I guess I'm curious to see, like, this was their first foot forward. The thing overall is that it makes me think of the Todd Howard approach, because it has a few things in common with Starfield in terms of being a very economical game in the new world, where we kind of expect first party stuff to be AAA quality, and then we expect that AAA bar to be the Naughty Dog quality or the Rockstar quality. And I just wonder, because Starfield was so assumedly intentionally economical in its design and was so, like, you can argue, like, you know, hobbled by its use of the engine it was on and, like, loading in between every instance of anything, even when you're docking a ship or something. I always kind of wondered how intentional that was. And then if you're Todd Howard going, like, well, I want to make an Indiana Jones game, and other than the movie, there's not really, like, a massive amount of hype for it.
Yeah.
The indie IP is pretty dead. How do I get this over the finish line? And then the conversations that happen and be like, okay, we're going to kind of... Even that stealth move, when you were mentioning the stealth in the new Indiana Jones... When he throws the hammer at the dude, it looks identical to the stealth move, let's say, in Wolfenstein.
Exactly right.
It's not like a full animation. It's just like, you know, they're going to react when they get hit. It's not like a canned thing. And so I was just like, okay, how much of this is a carryover? Even the bit when he grabs the dude and punches him is straight out of Chronicles of Riddick. Like, there's things that this dev team have worked on in the past that I can kind of see the parts being put together. But at the same time, the core of it is a bunch of people who want to make this.
Yeah.
And I think that for me is the big takeaway. I was like, you guys had fun making this, and you're just kind of getting it over the finish line. And that's, to me, that, like, I'm not saying you're not, that's not enough for you, but that is just by far enough for me. And it is quite rough around the edges, but, it's kind of, there's a weird innocence to it in a way where, like, this is Xbox first party. Like, you look at how much Sony are, like, blowing the doors off and spending almost $500 million on Spider-Man. And it's like, over on the Xbox side, they've got Game Pass. They announced that it's now 15% of their bottom line. Over 30 million people have Game Pass. And that means you get a bigger variety of games, but the overall, like, production level is lower. And is that enough? And it's like, I'm just so curious where this shakes out. Hi-Fi Rush was a good taste of it. And I'm just like, this is more in that vein to me. But you almost have to sacrifice a lot of polish for that.
That's true.
There's a weird thing to it.
You know what? I totally see that side of it. And I do think, you know, making a $300 million game, $200 million game, and then putting it out day one on Game Pass just can't be sustainable, even if you are Microsoft and you have endless amounts of money. Like, that can't last forever at all, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm absolutely fine. Like, you are, you know, scaling things back and having a more regular release schedule that, doesn't aim for a Naughty Dog level of quality or detail or a Rockstar level of detail. My only holdout with Indiana Jones on, like, a bigger scale is, does the team want to make it? You said there that you felt there was a lot of passion in it, and I definitely get that from Todd Howard. I don't doubt that Todd Howard absolutely has been dreaming of this game for years and decades, you know? But is Machine Games the right pick for it? Like, I know when they made the past two Wolfenstein games, you could tell their heart was in it. It was over every detail. You could tell that they were really dedicated to what they were bringing to life. Again, it's one trailer. I don't know yet, but I need to be convinced that they are passionate about Indiana Jones and haven't just been contracted to make an Indiana Jones game like how Square Enix were just contracted out an Avengers game. And you could tell from that that, you know, they obviously... I'm sure they had a bunch of people on that team who were passionate about the Avengers, but it didn't feel like it was the game they were dying to make in the same way that it felt like Insomniac was dying to make a Spider-Man game. And I just wonder about that with Indiana Jones, because that element of soul, that would get me in over the criticisms that I have. But I kind of need to be convinced of it. And I don't like being so down on a game, but I need to see more, essentially.
Yeah, I think from the passion side, I think for me it was just like you could tell, I thought you could tell that they cared about this fun little endeavor they were doing, because it's not what anyone expected from Machine Games. Everyone expected Wolfenstein 3. And it is an interesting thing when you look at their previous track record, and you can just imagine Todd Howard playing Wolfenstein 1 or 2 and being like, well, this reminds me of Indiana Jones. I'm killing a lot of Nazis. Wouldn't it be cool if we did an Indiana Jones game with this shooting model? And that's ostensibly what they've done. And then the money goes into getting Harrison Ford's likeness and kind of just go from there. And it's like, yeah, that idea of like how would Machine Games have ever arrived at this conclusion without Todd Howard steering the ship a bit? Like, probably not, or assumedly not. And did that affect Wolfenstein 3? I mean, the weird thing with Wolfenstein's development over the timeline of those games is that we got that Youngblood game, where it was like an attempt at making that co-op thing. There was the VR spin-off thing as well, which I think is a VR version of Youngblood. And it's like, did they know what they were going to aim for in terms of like, okay, we're passionate to make this next step anyway, and how much has been course corrected or taken off course by Todd Howard, because he is kind of the face and the voice of this thing, even though they had the other dude like leading the piece during the direct. Like, it's Todd Howard's vision apparently from everything else that we've talked about.
I did laugh, you know, obviously video game development isn't this simplistic, but I did laugh at Todd Howard being like, this is my dream game. I'm not going to get my studio to make it. I'm going to like contract it out to another studio that like might need a game, but I'm not bringing it in-house. You know, I'm just going to work on it with someone else, and it's their responsibility.
It's because he knows that Bethesda could not make that.
No, they like, definitely couldn't, like, to be fair.
No, they would do some weird thing where you load every time you pick up a different whip or something, or you like load every little Nazi stronghold you want to go into or something. But a fascinating thing. I never thought of Indiana Jones as this tip of the spear for the new generation of Xbox. I did think of that as Starfield, and me and you loved our time with Starfield. I still treasure that game and the time I had with it, even though I get the criticisms of it. But still, it was like Indiana Jones just always kind of felt like this fun little almost side project that we've got one of our first party teams to do, and now that Todd Howard's on board entirely legally, I guess he's, you know, they got acquired a few years ago, then it's just something he's wanted to put together, and we're just we can do that because we have all this Game Pass revenue, and Lord knows we have no idea what we're doing with everything else because Perfect Dark's on fire, so and Fable's somewhere apparently, and so it was a strange overall direct. Tell you what we actually never did.
Go on.
I guess this kind of factors in, but we never actually answered John Tay's question about do we think that adaptations can be done exceptionally. which kind of factors into the whole thing. It's like the indie IP, there's a way to distill that down into Harrison Ford likeness, using a whip, punching Nazis, and like it has a general swashbuckling kind of tale. That bit when they cut in the trailer to him on the plane, shooting with the big minigun thing, or the Tommy gun thing, and then jumping between plane wings, that feels like a new age indie thing where he does really super heroic stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it can be done well if you get to the essence of the IP. I think it just depends whether it feels like it's tacked on or not, which I guess in this case, it does feel like they wanted to make a fun thing. It's set between Raiders and... It was set between the first and second movie or something.
Yeah, Temple of Doom was the prequel, wasn't it? So I think it's set between Last Crusade and Raiders. Yeah, but yeah.
I've only seen... Thing. What's the one where he punches the man and he falls out the window in a plane? Whatever that is, I've seen that one.
I don't know. I actually can't. I can't recall myself.
I'm not an indiesman, but I remember seeing some bit where he punches a man in like a room full of tables. He's got a white suit on, and I think he punches him out of a window. Punches a lot of people in those.
He
movies,
does punch so. A lot of people, and like, he punches a lot of people out of windows. He's always jumping in and out of windows. That guy. No, I've not seen the films in ages. To be fair, I watched Dial of Destiny over the Christmas period, but I've actually not gone back to the first four. In probably a decade, in a long, long time. So yeah, I'm similar to you, where indie isn't my thing, but if you followed our news videos, you know I was actually quite excited to see what they had accomplished with the IP. But yeah, going back to what you said in the question about whether like adaptations can be done well, I would agree with what you were saying about, as long as they find the essence of what made the original so good, I think you absolutely can do a good adaptation. To me, the worst adaptations are just when they pull the iconography and that's it, you know. So the worst case scenario would be Indiana Jones, them going Harrison Ford's likeness, swashbuckling adventure, whip, punching Nazis, and that's all you get. It's just like, they're the tropes, we're bringing them in, we're playing the hits, but we don't know fundamentally what makes the franchise work. Not saying that's the case here, just I'm saying, like, you know, that would be the worst case scenario. Whereas adaptations of the past, kind of like, again, I go back to Spider-Man, you know, if I knew how much of a unique take Insomniac was putting on Spider-Man before it launched, I might have been worried, because I would be maybe thinking, oh, you're going to get away from what makes the franchise great or whatever. But seeing that in practice, I thought, oh, no, you've actually done something different here in something new. You've understood the characters enough to push them in new directions almost. So I'm not someone who needs everything to be exact in an adaptation. I don't need the actors to look the same or the plot points to be exactly the same or anything like that. But as long as whoever's making the thing understands the soul of the thing, then I think it can be done well.
Yeah, man. And the thing is, like, in terms of adapting for movies or TV, it's like, how much of a tapestry was there to pull from anyway? Does it feel like a complete story? What are you actually able to tag on? My mind, when you were talking about, I was thinking of the Scarface game, which, like, if they announced that now, like, the fundamental premise of the Scarface game is that he just didn't die at the end of the movie, which is, like, obviously a fundamental part of that story. And in the game, he just gets back up again. He's, his body's all riddled with bullets, and he's covered in blood, and he just gets back up. He's like, hey, I'm going to get my revenge. And then, and then the game is just that. But I love that game at the time, mainly because it has a swear button which you can just jam on as much as you want, and it was really, really fun. And so it's like, there's maybe ways to do it if you're intentional about how campy you're being about the premise, but for the most part, yeah, it has to get to the soul of it. There's nothing about the Scarface game that was about ultimately the soul of the Scarface movie in terms of the downfall of that character. It was just, let's just do a GTA style thing with the Miami with a 80s soundtrack and put it in Miami. But yeah, I think it's like, there's a way to get to the heart of it. I'm such a casual Indiana Jones fan, to bring it full circle, that this works with, like, when I think of what I would want from an Indiana Jones game, it pretty much is this. I agree with the people who are, the people who are annoyed or are pretty sad that it's in first person.
Hmm.
I like the hybrid thing because it always reminds me of Rainbow Six Vegas or something like that. And I think there's a way to make that immersive and, like, you know, you know that's your character in the cutscenes kind of thing. And you get to be them again. I would always take third over first overall. But I think in terms of the indie hype and everything, it works for me. Like, and I wonder if that's just what they're skewing for. Like, in Indiana Jones 101, like, there's a reason they de-aged him again in the most recent movie.
Yeah.
It's like, we're trying to get back to that era.
I think the first person also works to immediately dodge the bullet of comparisons to Tomb Raider and Uncharted as well. If it was third person, because Uncharted and Tomb Raider both crib, you know, heavily from
everything,
taking inspiration from indie itself, like, I think you would, you know, come up with direct comparisons, whereas, I don't know, first person and third person hybrid gameplay allows it, in my eyes, to differentiate it enough from those franchises to not be constantly compared to Sony's, you know, one of Sony's biggest franchises. Mm. And that has to be a win for the marketing and from the developers to not have that kind of constant pressure when they just want to make their own thing, but everyone's constantly comparing it to these other big franchises.
No, totally. I mean, I kind of, like, would have wanted them to steer into that. Like, it's like that thing of, like, you've got the cultural cachet to be like, this is the original one of those games. I don't know how you necessarily phrase it. And you don't need to be like, oh, these little imitators kind of thing. But there is a way to be in that space. And it's kind of a double-edged sword, the thing that you just described, because now they're fundamentally not part of that.
Yeah,
like, they're not alongside Lara Croft and Nathan Drake or the feel of those games. And now they have to try and, like, mimic the feel of going on an adventure and exploring and puzzle solving and combat and everything, and it's like a lighthearted, swashbuckling adventure, and then do that in first person, which is in itself not necessarily that well-worn ground. So it's like, it'll either work in their favor or it'll be distinguishable, or it'll be a thing where it's like, you know, we prefer this style of game in a Tomb Raider or an Uncharted sense.
Good point, man. Good point. I think, you know, the conclusion I've kind of come to after everything you've just said and everything I've just said, and the great question is, sack off Indiana Jones, get The Mummy the game into production, get Brendan Fraser's likeness, get the actors back, and just do it with The Mummy instead.
Yeah. Just let me play as Imhotep again. That was in the second Mummy game. That thing was awesome. We will wrap the Untitled Banter podcast now, though. The UPP. I've been Scott Tilford. That's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. Thank you to everyone for sending in various questions and everything. You're all bloody lovely. And we'll catch you very soon.
Bye-bye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.